common and related coding. And on each slide, there's going to be a bunch of multiple cycles we post it. So the main topics and themes we'll talk about is computational biology and bioinformatics, human-computer interaction, computer systems research, and software engineering. And these are by no means the only areas. There are many other areas that are strongly represented, like computer science education, numerical methods, data mining, digital libraries, and so on. So just wait till the end of the presentation. We're going to have some faculty come up and give you an overview, like Dr. Schaefer is going to talk about computer science education. So as we go through these topics, each of them is going to be presented by one faculty member. We're going to give you an overview, a very panoramic overview of everything that's happening in the area. But I want you to remember some takeaway messages, which is common across all of them. The first is there's a lot of breadth in all of these areas. So these are really, really broad topics. So as you go through these slides, you realize that the projects are value rich and encompass a broad variety of research. There's a lot of collaborations in each of them. There are collaborations within computer science. There are collaborations between computer science and other disciplines. And you also must take note of the facilities for research. Some of the research that's going to be presented really depends crucially on having access to, you know, equipment and capabilities that are not common. So that's another factor that you take into account. And finally, grad students are really central to research. So as we have opportunities, this presentation will point out the specific students who are involved in this research and so on, and you'll get an opportunity to meet them the rest of the day and tomorrow. So with that, I turn over to the chief theme leaders. The first one will be Dr. Murli. He's going to talk about computational biology.
Hi, welcome to Luxembourg Computing Tech. So I'm going to tell you about the research done in computational biology and bioinformatics at my department. And we call this CBB, because this is a mouthful to say. So what is computational biology? So essentially, it is the study using computational algorithms and models and techniques addressing these to study questions in biology, in medicine, human health, food production, epidemiology, and so on. So the reason this field is existing, it was only about 10 or 15 years old, is because there's a huge deluge of data in biology nowadays. You have heard of sequencing projects, for instance, the human genome project. And along with this, there have been a number of dramatic advances in experimental technology in biology, which gives us unprecedented insights into biological systems and provide very, very large amounts of data. So, you know, computer science is needed to analyze this data. So, in this group, the one key spirit that underlies research is that there's very close collaboration between biologists and computational scientists. So we work in multidisciplinary teams involving both students from both areas and faculty from both areas, and meet really regularly. Our education service approach stresses multidisciplinarity. So our goal in some sense is to try to educate those students who will be the next generation of leaders in the science and can actually try to straddle both the computational and the biological world of these. And we value contributions both to computer science and to biology and medicine in this type of research. We have a large number of faculty working in this area. Some of us work primarily in CBB. Some of us have joint appointments with the Virginia Bioinformatics Institute, which is at the other end of campus. And the other faculty in this list have partial interests in computational biology and also have very strong research programs in other areas of computer science. So what I'd like to do today is to give you a sample of the sort of research that goes on in this area, stressing the interdisciplinarity of the research. So if you think about life on this planet, in all its dazzling variety and complexity, it all starts, as Feynman said, with the wiggling and jiggling of atoms. But then atoms form molecules of proteins, they form cells, organs, organisms, ecosystems, and so on. So I'll try to tell you about projects that address many levels of these layers of complexity within the group. Proteins are the workhorses of the cell. An important protein is myosin, which, as some of you may know, is responsible for transporting oxygen to muscle cells in our body. It was the first molecule whose structure was discovered. And as soon as people realized what its three-dimensional structure is, there was a mystery that arose. How does oxygen shuttle in and out of the molecule? Because if you look at the tree structure and look around it, there is no obvious pathway. And this problem has been worked on intensively for 50 years, yet there was no clear solution. So Alexey Anufriev, who led the project and I worked with him, we collaborated with Michael Poussin of Biochemistry Duke University. And we used extremely long simulations of the motion of this molecule on system 10, our supercomputer, and new geometric algorithms. And we were actually able to probe inside the molecule and figure out the universe of all the paths that oxygen may take and establish essentially the first ever snapshot of what oxygen does inside the molecule. And it turned out that this result was able to tie together many apparently contradictory findings that have been presented in the literature over the last 50 years. If you're interested in this work, there's going to be a poster on myoglobin. It's easy to figure out what the poster is because it's the only poster of the word myoglobin in the title. Now, we talked about proteins, but they don't act in isolation. They actually talk to each other in the cell and form more and more complex processes. The cell cycle is one of these processes. It's the process by which cells divide and multiply. So starting from a fertilized egg all the way up to a fully grown organism, the cell cycle is responsible for controlling the division and growth of cells. This has been an object of intense study for over 60, 70 years in molecular biology. And biologists can figure out the conceptual idea of a cell cycle and tie together proteins into a reaction network. And because this is such an object of intense study, people in biologists even know the kinetics and rates of the reactions within the cell cycle. So we can actually set up differential equations which tell us what rate and what speed each reaction works within the cell cycle. And then, now that we have these differential equations, we can actually simulate them. So this research actually is pioneered at Virginia Tech by John Tyson and his collaborators in our department, Mary Morrison, Cliff Schaefer, Jacques Sauer, and Sandu. So the interesting thing is that with the simulation, you can start asking questions about the cell. What happens if I knock out a gene? How will the cell cycle respond? And this is critical because in diseases such as cancer, the cell cycle is always turned on. And such simulations actually give us an ability, a way to start probing cancer and understand what we can do to control cancer. So this sort of research uses very specific techniques for mathematical optimization, software engineering. HCI is involved here because we want to build software interfaces that biologists can interact with. So this is sort of research that provides many aspects of computer science.
Excuse me,
yeah.
You said that you can control cancer, but how exactly you control it? Do you have a control over the cell's life cycle? How do you control this?
So, very briefly speaking, you can ask what happens if I know that a gene is always turned on during cancer. In your model, you can ask, well, what happens if I turn the gene off? You ask how the cell might respond. And if you realize that the cell cycle, say, is stopped as a result of, is stopped as a result of mutating the gene, perhaps that gives you a drug target. Right? So if you want to know more about this, I'm glad you asked the question, there are four posters on this research and related research. So two posters with the word Jigsaw in them and two other posters on simulation and modeling of biological systems. So hopefully your questions can be answered in more detail at the poster session this afternoon. Now, cells themselves don't work in isolation. They communicate with each other. A pathological example of this is infectious disease, where viral proteins or pathogen proteins can actually attack the human cell cycle and subvert it for their own purposes, so they can do. So in this context, I'm involved in some of the research with colleagues at the University of Washington and the Virginia Lab and Plant Institute. We are actually trying to predict what we call broad spectrum drugs. So we want drugs that can simultaneously tackle multiple pathogens. And this research involves techniques from graph theory, data mining, and machine learning. And if you're interested in this work, there are a couple of posters on post-pathogen response networks and broad-spectrum drug targets, where we can give you more details about this research. So we talked about proteins. We talked about proteins communicating in cellular processes. We talked about cells communicating with each other. But ultimately, cells communicate and organize themselves into tissues and organs within the body. So a grand challenge in science, for instance, is to figure out what is the neural connectivity between neurons in the brain. And problems in neuroscience can now be addressed using computational techniques, because there are experimental techniques that can give us high throughput data, large amounts of data. So in this collaboration with between Narayan Ramakrishnan, Yang Sa, Wu-Feng, and Steve Porter at Georgia Tech, they looked at one type of chip, a microelectrode array, which can actually measure action potentials, so spiking activities of neurons in cell cultures. So they took this time series data, and they processed it using another chip. That's why it's called chip-on-chip neuroscience. This chip is just a graphics card that sits on your laptop or your computer. And from this massively parallel computation and data mining, they are able to figure out common spiking patterns, and from that, reverse engineer the connections between neurons in these neuronal cell cultures. So one day, presumably, this sort of technology can actually help us figure out how neurons are connected within our own brain. There are two posters related to this, related to multineural spike trains, which will give you more details. So from organs, we move on to organisms. Ultimately, an organism is made up of multiple organs. So at the level of organs, a major project in our department is studying plants, because Virginia Tech is a land-grant university. There's a very strong presence in plant biology at our university. So the NSF iPlant is a 5-year, $50 million effort coming out of the University of Arizona, whose goal is to build a infrastructure for plant biology. The idea is to take all possible kinds of data available on plants and give any plant biologist anywhere in the world ready access to them and sophisticated approaches to visualize and mine this data. So in this context, Virginia Tech is leading a multi-university effort to study what global climate change will have it on plants. So for example, what will drought stress cause? And global climate change can also cause flooding. So you also want to study extreme stresses that are caused by global climate change and what effects it has on plants. So Ruth Green in the Department of Plant Pathology is leading this effort, and Lenny Heath and Narayan Ramakrishnan from our department are participating in this. Now, organisms themselves also communicate. So in this context, there is this project from VBI and computer science where they're trying to figure out how diseases spread within human populations because of human-to-human contact. So the unique aspect of this research is that they're actually simulating extremely large contact networks between humans. So for instance, the population that they simulate and connections between them involves millions of people. So they can actually ask public policy questions. Can you figure out when has an epidemic started? Whom do you vaccinate in the population instead of vaccinating everybody? Are there key people you can vaccinate so that the epidemic is controlled as much as possible? And because of the large scale of the data, you really need very non-trivial techniques, high-performance computing, graph theory, simulations to solve these problems. I know that the word non-trivial sounds very modest. It's just a mathematician's modest way of saying this is really tough stuff. Right? It's not trivial, but it's really, really hard. Right? So we need really fresh young minds to work on these problems. So there are several grand challenges you might be able to work on if you were to join the CBB group and come here. For instance, can you build a virtual model of the cell? Can you engineer artificial tissues that can mimic organs within the human body? So, I've been talking about faculty so far, but as you might be guessing, all the hard work is really done by students. And this work is actually recognized, both at the university and at the national level. So Amrita Pratik, who was Lenny Heath's student, won the third prize at ACM Student Research Competition at the Grace Fuller Conference. Jory Smuda was the lead author of the Mycelium paper and was advised by Alex Nusfield, and David Bevan, and Matt Dyer, who Michael advised with Bruno Sobral, have both won outstanding student awards at Virginia Tech from the Carter School. And these people are going on to do great things. So for instance, Ranjit Dandhawa, who was Cliff Schaefer student and worked in the Jigsaw project, is now, I believe, earning obscene amount of money at Pfizer Research. Amrita and Doug Slaughter, who are advised by Lenny Heath, are working at research institutes devoted to biology. The Joint Genome Institute is the premier organization in the world for sequencing genomes, especially for microbes. NCBI is a key organization at the National Institutes of Health for giving biologists access to data. So any biologist every day will go to the NCBI websites for getting access to data on cells and organisms. Jory Ruscio, she is now a postdoc at the University of California at Berkeley, and Matt and Corbin Rivera are doing postdocs at the University of Washington and Johns Hopkins University. So I'm going to conclude by saying that this research we do in this group studies multiple aspects of biology and life on Earth. And our students are recognized for the research they do, both at the university and the national level. And this is the sort of work which will give you great salary.
Some of the human-computer interaction research that's been going on here at Virginia Tech. And here's our seemingly huge list, slightly larger than Roni's, of people who are working on HCI research. I can read it off from this angle. So HCI, human-computer interaction as a discipline, really sort of started taking off in the late 70s, early 80s. And one of the places that it really started taking off was here at Virginia Tech. And folks like Roger Eric and Rex Hartson and some faculty in the ISE department, Industrial Systems Engineering department, were really at the forefront of writing a lot of key grants and doing a lot of key work, writing the books and the papers and leading the conferences and other meetings that really defined what the field was and is. And as you can tell, we're really remaining a major player here. Typically, any poll recognizes one of the top 5 to 10 places in the country, places in the world to do HCI research. We've got a lot of people in computer science, and I always forget somebody's name on that list. Am I on the list? Yeah, I'm there. Lots of people in computer science who I think would primarily call their primary area HCI. Lots of others that could be added here, probably come up with a bigger list. And then as well, HCI has a university level center, Center for HCI, which has helped us attract, there on the right, lots and lots of collaborators who are in other departments, industrial systems engineering, ISC, information design technology, music psychology, architecture, tons and tons of different collaborators really recognize human-computer interaction as an important discipline. Yes, you do the underlying technology work, but you want people to use it, you want people to do things with it, and so forth. So what are some of the advantages of having so many people doing HCI work? Well, one of them is that we put together some great facilities for doing that work. And here's an example of one of them, the Black Lab, which was really led by the four people whose names are up there at the top, but a lot of the grants and so forth that helped form this lab had, you know, 15, 20, 30 people's names on it. So there are lots and lots of people who sort of define what this lab would be about and so forth. Here in the upper left is an example of one of the chunks of technology, what we call the gigapixel display, which is more of a towards the gigapixel display. I don't think we're actually up to a gig of pixels yet. And yeah, it looks like a whole bunch of monitors duct taped together. There's a little bit more behind it than that. But what that allows us to do is really sort of lay out some of the hard problems that are beginning to exist with these very pixel-dense displays. So for example, as a somewhat trivial but very important example, you know, if you sit down at your computer with your one or two or three monitors and you can't figure out where your mouse pointer is, instead of looking around for a minute, or you wiggle your mouse for a minute and you find it, you know, you can't so much do that when you're talking about 20 or 30 or 40 monitors quite as easily. So we look at techniques for doing things like that. And then, of course, if you get into more complex interactions, how you select lots of different things, and as you get into the things that are afforded by this type of display that aren't afforded by, you know, a single or two or three monitor display, like, you know, what happens when two or five or ten people are all using this at the same time, that's when you really need to sort of get into different interaction paradigms. You know, what sorts of things can you do with this technology? What sorts of other equipment, which a lot of that you see there around the periphery of the larger picture, are necessary for us to develop to make these sorts of things happen? And what sorts of projects can you tackle with this that you can't tackle otherwise? So here's one example of the types of interdisciplinary projects that are undertaken with some of these technologies. And this is now this is a crowd simulation animation system that is led by Yong. There he is. And includes a lot of people in HCI, but also a lot of names of people that are in other areas as well. So what's going on here is that you are seeking to simulate lots and lots of people. So as you might guess, that takes lots and lots of computational power. And then learn things about those large numbers of people. So yeah, you need the people that are driving the simulation to be tracked in some way. You need some way to display all that sorts of information. And you need some hard problems to deal with. And they're really tackling some interesting things, like what happens when you have large numbers of people in a small space. You can sort of anticipate what would happen, you know, if a large crowd descended on Washington, D.C. or Blacksburg, Virginia, or something along those lines. You could, say, recreate an ancient Roman battle, for example, which is a project that's actually in the works here. Things of that ilk. So you can sort of understand things like that would be hard to do without this sort of simulation. Another project that I'm working on, this time with a researcher outside of computer science, Goldie Harrell, who's actually got degrees in computer science and mechanical engineering. We're looking to address the way that people develop interfaces. So, you know, currently people do a lot of things with paper, ironically, and there are some good reasons for that. And you see some of these here with people manipulating a lot of photographs and pictures and so forth as they put together storyboards or create affinity diagrams or things of that ilk. So they're trying to understand sort of the flow of actions that can be storyboarded or what things belong together, what are common tasks that people do together, so that you can choose between different options and develop a better interface that best meets some real human needs. And we do a lot to understand those types of activities. So what is it that people do in those instances? And we run actual sessions like the one you see here on the left, where, you know, people are grabbing and touching and manipulating a lot of pictures of state-of-the-art interaction techniques towards understanding how they can be integrated into new series of actions that people do to help drive real interfaces. So there's some good reasons that you wouldn't do that on a lot of technology that existed 5 or 10 years ago and is commonplace today. And we've actually seen a lot of that. So if you have technology and you place it in the classroom, for example, and you want like an example of a system that we put into middle schools, if you want 3 or 4 middle school students working on one computer, what do you end up with? You end up with everybody fighting over who gets to hold the mouse, right? Who gets to drive, in essence. And what we're looking at is, now that we have all these monitors, now that we have all these input devices, now that we can use this new technology, how does sort of these types of activities combined with the computational power, the ability to sort and search and do other things very quickly that you can't do with sort of a cacophony of paper-based materials, how can you do that using technology, using a series of projections? projectors, using things like the gigapixel display in the black lab, things of that ilk. And that's where we plugged in with some of the mechanical engineers. So we've got computer scientists who seems like people always get excited about doing things that aren't in their own area. So there was nothing cooler for a lot of these computer science students than to really get their hands dirty and nail things together and embed sensors into these wooden frames. And basically what we created was, the person that did it isn't here, so I'll say it this way. We created like a giant mouse pad that's got a projector underneath that projects all the information. So you can do things like this sort of multi-touch work here that would be kind of hard to do instead of a standard display. We created a system, in the process of creating a system, that supports that type of behavior. It could be used in sort of a standalone situation. It could be used in conjunction with, say, something like a gigapixel display, something along those lines that would help support those types of activities. So another project that is active here is a collaborative space exploration project called PlaceMark, and yes, those are real people outside. So we do let folks that are doing research in human computer interaction go outside, but you do have to carry your laptop with you. So what's going on here is again a collaboration between people in the Center for HCI, Deborah Tater and Steve Harrison. Steve is sitting back there, as well as a professor at Highlands University, which is a women's college up the road in Roanoke, where a lot of y'all flew into, and Jen is not in computer science. She's actually in English, creative writing. And what one of the driving concerns here is what's going on is they've got these laptops that are, in essence, location aware. So they know where they are, and they know what sort of things are around them, and so forth. So you can geotag a lot of the interactions that you're doing, a lot of the writings that you're doing here as you go through any sort of physical space. It could be a building, it could be an outdoor activity, and so forth. And there are a lot of those systems out there, but what's really unique here, as you might guess from the English professor as a collaborator, is that there is equal, if not greater, focus on the things that they're writing, the ways that they're writing, and the ways that those writings are read by other people and contributed to by other people, and so forth. So, for example, the blogging phenomenon that's going on now, meshed with this geotagging, is leading to a lot of very interesting results. They developed an interface that allows people to sort of be aware of these sorts of things as they enter a geotag space and contribute to and grow sort of a repository of knowledge within a space. And now that I've sort of butchered everybody else's work and undersold my own work because my students are always ahead of me doing the actual work, I encourage you to go out and find out the truth about all of these sorts of things. We've got lots and lots of posters that are going to be presented at the afternoon poster symposium. We've got a number of demos that are going to be shown tomorrow when y'all go out to the Knowledge Works building. And I encourage you to, I think all of the projects that I talked about, as well as many, many more, obviously, are going to be represented at one, if not both, of those activities. So I encourage you to go out there, find out more about the project, ask lots of questions,
PhD students and about 25 master's students. Over the last several years, we've graduated many more in between. So what is the kind of work just at a very high level that we do in systems? So systems, at least good systems, sits at the intersection of three different areas. We do implementations, we do software, and quite a bit of theory as well. Without the combination of those three factors, you end up with work that tends to be fairly superfluous otherwise. Most of our work is a combination of all of these three aspects. And I'll talk about some of the bigger problems that we're working on these days. Second part of systems is you build your stuff. You have an idea, you have an algorithm that goes behind it, you build your stuff, you prototype. You may prototype it first at, say, a lab level scale, maybe a few machines, or a single chip that you come up with. The next part of it is, okay, you've got this chip or this idea that you come up with is really good. You want it to go out to industry, you want other people to use it. You need to test it out at scale. So prototyping is the first step. Second part of it is take the problem up at scale, see what it will do in, say, a real world scenario. This is where emulation and simulation techniques come. What if you're building a system where you have the resources to build, say, 16 components of this machine, and you want to test it out, what is it going to do? You need 10,000 of them. This is where simulation emulation techniques come in. We work in these areas as well. So effectively, any good work in systems is essentially the design of a system, its core architecture, and something new at the heart of it. And contrary to popular belief, you have to have a good idea at the core of it. No amount of slick coding in systems ever gets past a bad design. I can give you an example. One of my own students many years ago, probably about 10 years ago nearly, working on a game engine. The goal there was, we didn't have graphics accelerators that were that quick. We used a cluster of graphics accelerators, about 16 of them, when the first graphics accelerators were coming out, the first GeForce accelerators. And the game engine was being used to actually do a project for the Navy. Where they were modeling what is called a crane ship. This is essentially a ship with a very large crane model. And the simulation is very sophisticated. It simulated the wave motion of the ocean. It simulated the dynamics of the ship. It simulated the crane arm. And what it was trying to do was present the view from the perspective of the operator of that crane. So there was a tessellation that had to be done for this. It was taking 18 hours to do that for that particular data set. Changing the algorithm and then reduce that from there to 2 minutes. And this is what happens in my implementation essentially. The formula was unusable. We have several research labs that focus on various areas of systems. So if you look at the faculty group that we have in systems, we have folks that work in architectures, we have folks that work in networks, we have folks that work in low power systems, we have folks that work in supercomputing, we have folks that work in runtime systems. We have folks that work in storage. We have folks. So this sort of represents a gamut of specialties that we have. In addition, we have folks in runtime systems, compilers, things of that nature as well. There are several labs in the facility. We have a computing systems research lab, distributed systems and storage, laboratory for advanced scientific applications. We have emerging architectures.
Yeah.
We have scalable performance. And then we have systems networking and Renaissance. So I'll give you sort of a flavor of the various areas that folks have projects in, instead of going into specific projects. There are about tens of different fairly sophisticated projects going on currently within the so a sample of them. So we can sort of categorize them into various areas. One of them is usability. If you look at large-scale supercomputing systems these days, over the last like 10 years or so, the growth curve has been very, very strong. So most of you are familiar with Moore's Law. 18 months, the cost of a transistor goes down by half. Essentially, you end up in the same area being able to pack, roughly speaking, twice as many transistors. Supercomputing doesn't follow Moore's Law. It's super linear on Moore's Law. So if you look at the growth in supercomputing systems, every year, biannual, twice a year, it grows by 50%. Our programming models, on the other hand, don't. Our standard programming model has been around since sort of the birth of computing. We've been used to looking at supercomputers as machines with thousands of processors. That has changed over the last 5 years from thousands being the largest machines to hundreds of thousands being the largest machines. Our programming models are 20 years behind. So now if I were to pose a problem to you and say, here is a problem, here is an algorithm, here is a problem from, say, biology, you have 300,000 processors available to you. How would you make your problem run faster? basic way of how do I have to view the problem in order and break it down in a way that I can get usable efficiencies out of my large scale machines. So there are the fundamental computing problems in this area. Just trying to figure out what is the model of computing. How do I use these processes? How do I break my problem down? How do I even think of it? This is the decomposition that has to occur mentally for me to be able to take this problem and effectively run it on a large machine. How do I improve the utilization of these large machines? Utilization numbers vary considerably. Most parallel computers are not used 100%. Not because they don't want to be, because sometimes problems don't fit the size of the machine. The size of the machine is odd. Problems don't fit. There are problems that only like square sizes, so they're always like powers or something. How do I improve these effectively on large machines? How do I make supercomputers resilient to faults? If you look at a modern supercomputer, even a cluster supercomputer, 1,000 nodes. Let's assume you paid a huge amount of money to make each of your nodes very reliable. So your average desktop stays up for a year without crashing. So if I engineered a very nice server platform that can stay up for a whole year without crashing, I put 1,000 of them together, I've got 1,000 crashes a year. That's 3 a day. And for a parallel application that's running on 1,000 nodes, that's 3 crashes a day. And any one node going down brings the whole application down. So that's about a problem. Some of the largest machines have reliability of the ENIAC, the first machine. The first sort of public machine that was ever built, ENIAC had a reliability of 6 minutes. Some of the large machines are in that era. So how do we make these systems resilient to faults? How do we build a set of devices, protocols, services that protect personal information? This is an area that's just started up in combination with HCI. Work in operating systems. So how do we improve operating systems, file systems? If you look at most problems today in industry, they are bottlenecked by I/O, they're not bottlenecked by computing. The average computer utilization is about 7%. Most of the time you're stuck on I/O. And when you're stuck on I/O, how can you improve I/O performance? Second is, if you've got multiple applications running on the same platform, how do I ensure that each application is making fair progress towards its goals? That is, one application is not hogging resources on the system that another application should be getting. There's basic notions of fairness over here, the fair scheduling. How do I improve the performance of operating systems as a whole? And the first part over there, improving the performance of operating systems as a whole, is how do we even get information from the operating system on what is currently going on? The OS is a fairly complex piece of software, and it has things that happen within it in the order of microsecond timescales. How do I view this information? Then you're working power over it. You look at it. I'm sorry.
In operating system area, do you have like a research concerning to real-time operating system?
To some degree, yes. We do have some projects that do work in real-time operating system areas. We also have work in like post-scheduling, a bunch of other allied areas with that as well. If you look at energy consumption these days, you've probably all seen or heard of Google's large data centers, Microsoft's large data centers. There's quite a few of these companies with enormous data centers. In fact, one of them that most people don't mention is oil and gas. Oil and gas systems, the large systems, are 50,000 nodes. And there are multiple systems within a single oil company. So data centers actually started off being a very small fraction of the world energy consumption. They're projected now to reach 10% of the entire world's energy consumption. It's a huge number. There's no single area that you can point to and say they consume 10% of the world's energy. The only other areas that compare are light. There's a Philips presentation I've seen which they actually said light bulbs consume the most energy in the world. Data centers are starting to reach those kinds of numbers. So how do you improve power efficiencies in data centers? If I tell you, based on the statement I made earlier, 7% average utilization of the server, 93% not being used because it's still spending the energy on keeping those systems running. So the interesting question over here is it possible to reduce your power consumption and get some nonlinear benefits, which is you give up a little bit in performance, but gain a lot more in energy? What kind of work is possible there? Can we do this with high-end computing systems? Can we make supercomputing systems that are usable by a large fraction of people that consume a lot less energy than they do today? When we look at power consumption of supercomputers today, we generally talk in megawatts. And megawatts power 1,000 homes, single megawatt. In terms of architecture, as I mentioned earlier, our processing systems are going from hundreds of cores to thousands, tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands of cores. And these are not just general purpose cores. Earlier you saw both folks in HCI as well as folks in bioinformatics that are using non-traditional cores, particularly graphics chips. Modern graphics chip today, like a Tesla, has about 240 cores. Bigger versions of that have over 1,000 cores on it. How do you program for these systems? How do you efficiently build these systems also? Then finally, networks, building the next generation of protocols, and simulation and emulation environments. So let's say you come up with the next great idea for a network protocol, you've tested it out, and now you want to deploy it at internet scale. 500 million machines are going to be on the board. How do you know it's going to scale? So in terms of facilities, we tend to build a lot of our stuff. We have very, very good facilities. We probably are, when it comes to systems research and high-end systems, are the premier place in the country in terms of what our resource capability is. We built the System 10 supercomputer in 2003. This was a number 3 supercomputer in the world. It's a 2200 processor, PowerPC based machine with a very fast interconnect. At least for its time, it was the fastest interconnect, with 10 gigabit per second per node. We had a backplane of about many terabits per second. Prior to that, we had built Ananthan, which over many years grew to a 400 processor system. It started off in 99. Then we have several 8 to 32 processor research clusters. We have both shared memory machines as well as distributed memory machines. Our newest entrant is a machine called System G. Focus here is on programming models and in power by computing. System G is a 2600 processor, 2600 core. Machine, 2.6 TB of main memory, and also has one of the fastest interconnects now in the world. It's a quad data rate, InfiniBand, 40 gigabit per second per link. So we have many terabits per second again in the backplane on the system. The interesting thing about a machine like System G is that it enables you to do basic computer science systems work on a large scale platform. Typically, people have been limited by trying out parallel algorithms in particular, or parallel systems work, in not having a research resource. If you go to a national lab and say, I need to do something with the kernel. I'm writing a new driver, or I'm changing the scheduling mechanism within the operating system. It's going to make a machine unstable. You're not going to get access to a large scale machine. So how do you ever show that your idea is good? This is the machine that provides this. Its fundamental use cases, it will be unstable. People in there are doing systems work. The machine itself as a whole is unstable. But for individual research projects, it provides us a very large scale resource. We have a huge number of sensors on this machine. We have about 12,000 thermal sensors and another 5,000 power sensors on it. Enables us to do very fine grained power and thermal on the machine.
Excuse me.
Yes.
System G, does it have logically shared memory?
Ah, good question. Separate? So currently it is distributed memory. The memory is all distinct. Each node is 8 gigabytes of memory. But we have a shared memory project running on it currently.
Because 64-bit address space is...
That's correct.
It's
practically infinite, yes. So right now, at least, it's practically infinite. And we are actually building a shared memory system on that. So you will actually have access to a small runtime. Part of the project is being able to even run standard pre-threaded codes, as if they were running a shared memory machine. This was our first machine, Ananthan. As you can see, it is duct tape. This is the nicer one that we built in between. System 10. We don't have any pictures of System G yet because it's still mostly in update mode. As of today, tonight it should be back in not as much of a paper scenario. In terms of several achievements, faculty, there's about 6 career awards that flight is unfortunately a big day. The 2 career awards from the Department of Energy, there are several faculty awards and dean awards. We won best paper awards at several major conferences. We're probably one of the top 5 places in the country in high-end systems research. We won challenges at supercomputing several years, actually. And finally, we do our student send-off, most of the premier places. We have students, in, multiple students in most of the major Fortune 500 systems companies that you can think of, Cisco, Intel, Microsoft, NetApp, variety of universities, also into to research labs, you know, places like Google. We've had folks in Google's Summer Code of Challenge, both from our undergraduate program as well as folks in my undergraduate program, multiple times. So with that, I'll end my work on systems.
afternoon.
Well, it's now 5:09. I am Dr. James Arthur. I'll be giving a little presentation on software engineering group here and some of the research that we're doing here at Virginia Tech. I told my wife, Terry, who is, by the way, one of the undergraduate advisors here, I told her I was going to give this presentation. And she looks at me a little inquisitively. She says, well, Sean, she says, you know how to make it effective? And I said, well, tell me, huh? She says, well, you have a good introduction, you have a good conclusion, and you keep very close together. She obviously knows the propensity and faculty to be long-winded. So I will try to do that. You know, it's certainly been enlightening from my standpoint to see a lot of the other people doing their presentations and the work that they've been doing. But being the astute graduate students, the prospective graduate students that we are, you know, we all recognize that there is a common thread running through all of that. And it's software, okay? Someone has to build a software to have all these systems. Well, that's what we're about. So, you know, software engineering really, the term was coined back at NATO Software Engineering Conference back in 1958, back in just the NATO conference. And Fritz Bauer was when he coined the term software engineering. And he really stated that, you know, it was a provocative and implying the need for software manufacturing to be based on types of theoretical foundations and practical disciplines that we find in the traditional established branches of engineering. That was the way, that was the genesis. And today, the way we think about software engineering is how do we build, first of all, a quality product, and we want to be able to build it on time, and we want to build it within budget. So that's where we come from a software engineering perspective. Now, And rather than list out all the people, I'm just going to just display some pictures here, show you what we look like, so you know you can model us at the end, you know, never talk to us and so forth. Dr. Ryder is one of our first software engineers that I'm going to present. She's also our department head, and she works in these areas down here of basically implementation, integration, testing, and maintenance. Now, what her research area is, we're both of focused is on static and dynamic programming analysis. And in particular, she will take, and her group takes, both the execution histories as well as the static component of the different programs and so forth, provide analysis on those to detect certain things such as performance bottlenecks and so forth, like in Java when you have the overuse of temporary variables. She also works down here in change impact analysis, and that is you do an analysis on the code, on the and determine between the original code, the change code, do an analysis, connect the dots in terms of where the changes impact the different pieces of the code, and then when you do things like regression testing and so forth, if there's an error, then it's much easier then to understand to find that locality of where the fault occurred, and then determine the extent and places to be able to go in and look at the actual code to determine where that fault is. Dennis Kufura is also one of the software engineers. It was our former department head for about, 8 to 9 years. And his work is in the grid computing area where what he looks at is how to go in and marshal all these computers that are sitting out there and use some of the spare CPU cycles and so forth, and use them effectively. He's worked with this system called Symphony, or a framework, which is a framework for actually going in composing and manipulating grid applications. Now, that has been extended to provide a uniform interface that allows us to have a uniform interface that allows us to look at various and multiple types of grids and grid architecture. He is also into grid security. When you really think Dr. Osman Balchi is a third. His area, he's up here in architecting and design. He has two different research focuses going on right now. One is in visual simulation-based software paradigm, where, look, what we want to be able to do is to look at architecture, look at a software architecture, and visualize it. Go in, modify it, modify the actual architecture itself, and then simulate the impact of that modification on the quality of the resulting architecture. We would like to be able to build upon the architecture, and that is what this environment is proposed to do. Yeah, I mean, it's a proposal out right now, and we're hoping that that gets funded. He also works in service-oriented architecture, and in particular, security for service-oriented architecture is currently being applied to network-centric architecture. And one of the graduate students, I mean, she got in here, is working on producing one of the PhD work is producing this hierarchy of indicators that allows us to go in and determine to what extent network-centric architectures are not secure. Dr. Talbot, who is back here now, Dr. Talbot is kind of a rare breed because he's got his foot in two domains. He's a systems as well as software engineer. It's really a great blend. His work is in up here in design and implementation, as well as down here in maintenance. Now, he has, in talking with him, the three different research areas, and the third one, I just think it's amazing. The first two, though, is like programming tools for distributed computing middleware. He's worked with, for example, there's a lot of overhead when you want to do procedure calls and so forth through XML. So what he's done, he's gone in, he's now doing batch remote method invocation, batching together actually Java, RMI, and sending those over as one unit, getting the computations that you need and then getting that information back, rather than sending a lot of disparate XML commands across. He's also into automated software enhancement, change propagation, for automatic and legacy systems. Some of the work that he does has to do in this area has to do with what you all would understand to be hot swapping, but it's not quite hot swapping in the sense that it's called the granularity at which he works. And so he's made changes, for example, to the Java virtual machine to allow you to go in and swap out components as systems are executed. And this is very crucial when you have these huge systems that's been running for, been up to 90 months. You can't afford to take them down and then reboot them, but yet you've got to be able to go in and do maintenance, so you want to be able to just go in and pull out a piece of the executing software and put a replacement in and do it in a way that it doesn't bring the system down.
So, excuse me, does it mean that some programs are running and they are using some methods and location from some class libraries, and you basically replace those class libraries dynamically?
Yes, that is what he does. Okay, is that right, Tyler? Yes. And he can certainly give you a lot more information about it. And the problems and the concerns and the issues that you have to worry about, especially when it's running and you don't want to bring it down, it's tremendous. You know, it's just it's pervasive. You know, I mean, you think about it. I mean, I do a lot of work with the Navy. I think about missile systems. I wouldn't want a missile system in flight, and all of a sudden I pull out some of the guidance software and put it back to it. I wouldn't want it to go bad because then it might come down. Or flying an airplane, something like that. Now, the third work we were talking about, I found really, really neat. It's using sonification to improve program comprehension. Now, when you think about it, sonification, what do? We try to study programs. You know, we sit there, it's visual. We have visual cues. And we sit down, we look at the code. Now, we can have visual presentations of the structures and so forth. But let's use another sense. Let's use another one of our senses. Sound. How can we use provide another axis of information coming in that gives us an better understanding of what the program is about, both structurally as well as from an executional standpoint. So he is in the process with some other people of breaking the ground on the sonification as an approach to improve the program. Dr. Grotchenen is also what we consider a software engineer. He works in the architecting, design, and implementation. Now, you know, the nice thing about what Dr. Grotchenen does, if you notice, there's a tremendous overlap with the HCI, and in particular with 3D user interaction, where he looked at PetriNets and, of course, communicated sequential processing that used to identify usability problems in software. He's also worked in 3D user interfaces from a visual standpoint with the head-mounted display, the K, and so forth. And the nice thing about he also has to put in the software engineering side is right now there is one of the real challenges in software engineering is that we have usability engineering and we have, on the HCI perspective, we have the software engineering from our perspective, and right now they're not talking. And when they come together down at design, you've got a lot of conflict in terms of requirements. How do you mesh those two together? That's one of our problems in software engineering. It's nice to have the insights of people that's in HCI to be able to provide that. Scott's also, Dr. Pritchard is also working on that. So there's, I hope you understand there's a lot of overlap in all the different disciplines here at Tech. Dr. Gush is also working with wireless services and wireless system networks, and in particular, how we can view those that allow us to assess their effectiveness, as well as comparing different wireless sensor networks. Dr. Edwards is also one of our software engineers. He's working from the programming languages standpoint, in particular, formal methods in programming languages. He did a lot of work with Resolve framework. Resolve is a system or a framework that allows you to reason about programming correctness based on the constraints that you insert into the code or into the specification. He's also into automated testing and tools and methods for automatic testing and case generation. He and his group have built the WebCat system, which is used all over the world, that is, it pushes this notion of test-driven development, which we're also seeing emerging in the agile software engineering domain. So very innovative from that standpoint. He's also done work in component-based software engineering. There's also this good-looking fellow that works up here in the user needs up in the front end of the requirements, software engineering process, the requirements, architecting, and design. And where I like to dive a little bit is in requirements engineering and particular capability-based specification for large-scale software systems. One of the problems with large-scale software systems is that they emerge over time. Well, and I'm talking about 5 to 10 year development lifecycle that you see with these systems. And one of the problems is by the time you get to the end, all the requirements have changed up here. Well, you can't go back and rechange them. It's very difficult to do. There's a lot of overhead. So capability specification is one way to mitigate the problems that we have there. Also, we work in security and security specification. One of the things that you never see in a set of requirements that come out is what are the security specifications? Or at least what you see is the negative security, the negative constraint. You know, the system shall not do this. Well, how is that testable? It shall not allow anyone to break into it from the internet. How do you test that? Okay? And so what we're about is how do we formulate these things? We have something called access driven DBMP, where we're looking at different aspects of the software development lifecycle. How you actually go in and integrate requirements. I'm also doing some work in the agile perspective of software engineering, assessing, I just had a PhD student graduate that worked on assessing the organization's agile potential. We're looking at special case software, such as mission critical, life critical systems, because to some extent, approach and you're in the mission and life critical system. And then more recently establishing the measures of software quality. Now, as I mentioned earlier, you know, there is one thing that really pervades all the stuff we see, all these presentations that we see, and it is software. So with that in mind, I guess the bottom line part of what we like is that we are all software engineers. Thank you.
Sense of how active the area is. We've got people doing all sorts of stuff. I do algorithm visualization. Steve Edwards has this WebCat project for tool development for supporting education. We've got lots of projects with people in middle schools. In fact, where my daughters go to school, we've got Virginia Tech people walking in and out there all the time, instrumenting all sorts of experiments and things that they're doing. So all sorts of stuff going on. So I just wanted to put in a plug for what's actually one of the biggest research groups in the department.
And there are also going to be many posters on computer science education, supposedly. So with that, we conclude our overview of visiting folks got a good idea of research in the department. And I'm sure you'll be meeting all of them.